Welcome back to the latest installment of the Will Work for Purpose podcast. Today, I'm joined again by J.K. Rieke, who was a guest that I had previously on, and together we talk about a book that I recommended in our last session titled Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. The book is a meditation on the Holy Fool and teaches us how to live life with new eyes and a new and fresh perspective. If you're interested in that, please stick around and enjoy the show. And so without further ado, here is the latest installment of the Will Work for Purpose podcast. So today we're joined again with J.K. Rieke, and we'll be talking about a book that I recommended in the last time we spoke. It's called Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. And you can see it on the screen there. And today we're just going to kind of be talking about the book, the themes, some of the thoughts that we had while we read it. And so there'll be substantial spoilers because pretty much nothing will be off limits in this. Although even if you were to listen to us talk about it for an hour, it would still be worth picking it up and reading it or listening to it if that's your method of consumption. Of course you could also just exit right now, go read it, listen to it and come back. But even if you just sit through and listen to this, don't let this be a deterrent from you reading the book, because it is, it's very profound, and just a delightful read. Even if you don't get anything profound from it, even if you just read it as a storybook, it's still a good story. I guess we'll just kind of start getting into a bit of the book. So I guess what was sort of the first thing that stuck out to you when you were reading it, like the first, like, I don't know, I guess it's the first theme or the first scene or something that like really stuck out to you at the beginning.
Yeah. So I would say that, obviously I read the book, on your recommendation, and I'm thrilled at that because it was everything that you said it would be. Interestingly, the first almost chapter, I guess, didn't really grip me all that much. It kind of reminded me in a little way of the final book of the space trilogy by C.S. Lewis. Mm-hmm. The first two books just like instantly grabbed me and I was in immediately. But the third book, he even wrote a foreword to that said, hey, look, the beginning of this book is kind of be boring, but I need it to be because it's on purpose. So in a way, the beginning of this book really sets up that almost mundane life that's going on before it really starts jumping into things. But the nice thing was it didn't drag on too much. It was like the right amount of mundane before Innocent Smith jumps onto the page. I guess it's tricky because I don't know how many people listening are going to have read it versus not read it, but maybe a quick summary. There's the story of a boarding house called Beacon House. The boarders at this house are some interesting but pretty mundane folks. And as the English breeze comes in one day, so does this strange gentleman with a too small head and a big green coat, kind of like Mary Poppins, and just kind of turns things upside down. So as soon as he appears and it really starts getting going, that's when the story, I think, really grabs you. And I think that it needed that beginning part of just being mundane before that happens, so that you could establish that things are normal and then you could go crazy with it, which is what kind of took place.
Yeah, I agree. Whenever I first went through it and I first like sort of read some reviews of it, and I thought, you know, I typically don't go for these types of books that are so like just everyday, you know, like how interesting is it going to be, you know, just sort of talking about normal people in a normal setting, doing normal things, you know. I don't read realistic fiction. I don't read murder mysteries or, you know, crime novels or any, you know, I typically don't read anything like that. I typically read nonfiction and fantasy, you know? So if my fiction is fiction, it's really fiction, you know? And so it's funny that you made the comparison to the last book of the Space Trilogy, because that's, I made that same comparison, or at least I drew those same lines, but not at those points. Like if you've in the Space Trilogy, it's written by C.S. Lewis, and the last book is called That Hideous Strength. And in that book, the assault takes place on Earth, and it sort of develops over time, but eventually all the good guys end up in one house together. And for whatever reason, Beacon House reminds me of Logurst, or the house that all the good guys live in the Space Trilogy, or in that Hideous Strength, because it's sort of like it's like its own ecosystem, you know, or it's like its own nation. In Man Alive, they talk about the High Court of Beacon, you know, where it's like, you know, home rule for homes. And so this lawyer figure talks about developing like basically making government so local that it pertained to each house, you know. It starts off as a joke, but like Innocent Smith turns everything upside down, you know. He starts to treat it as a reality almost, you know. And I guess so. So
I really like your comparison there with the houses. I didn't see that, but then it totally fits perfectly. It kind of reminds me in a little bit of a way of what we talked about last time we chatted with small communities. Mm-hmm. Those two houses are like their own little countries, their own little thing. And I don't know if it's the same for you, but I found myself wanting to be part of it. I was like, man, that would be super cool to live that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know even necessarily how realistic it would be to do so, but even through this fictional fantasy of it worked for the books and the stories, it was compelling to me in that way.
No, I totally agree. It's one of those things where it's like you want to be on the inside of whatever that is. It kind of reminds me of C.S. Lewis has an essay called Membership, I think, and it's about clubs, basically. And he talks about like there's like a diabolical theme to some membership, like he talks about people being able to do horrible things because they have the approval of their compatriots, like they have like people around them supporting them no matter what they do, and so even if they do something bad, they'll still receive like positive reinforcement. But he also talks about the sort of sweetness of being brought in on something, even if you don't like all the people in it, like just the fact that you were considered and brought in into a group that has some important mission or goal, how that can feel whenever you finally gain entry or membership to the club. And like I totally agree, when I was looking at both of those books, it's like it would just be interesting to be there in the room. And like it's one of those things that's it's like each person in there, like, they didn't choose to sort of be in community together in some sense, you know, like they're all brought together by different means and methods or whatever, you know, like in the case of That Hideous Strength by C.S. Lewis, it was like Oyarsa or Maleldil or God sort of bringing them all together to work for one common purpose. And then like in the case of Beacon House, it's sort of like they're all, you could say the same thing, but it's less evident. And it's more like they're just kind of like, oh, I need a room, I'm going to stay here. And like, it was just kind of like happenstance that they're all brought together. And
Definitely. And in a sense, when you're talking about clubs, it was almost like the Beacon House was already a club, but they didn't know it. And then Innocent came along and showed them, hey, look what you're part of. And then they were like, oh my gosh, this is great.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's kind of a theme through the whole book, is it's this sense of, look what you've already got. What is wrong with you, in a sense? Like, you're just like, if you just open your eyes a little bit, you're going to see something vastly different. And I think it's amazing that 100 years later, or however long, that's kind of what we need. It's like the remedy for today is this book. And it's just amazing to me that that's cyclical, I guess, or it's just timeless, yeah. I suppose.
Yeah, it's like one of those things. It's all like, because my favorite part, one of my favorite parts of the book is when Innocent Smith is unpacking his luggage, when he gets into the room and like, I can't remember who goes up and helps with the unpacking, but someone's sitting there watching him unpack his things. And he pulls out all sorts of different things like that, different things. And like, he pulls out a bottle of wine. And he's not interested in the bottle of wine. He's more interested in the paper that the wine is wrapped in. Or like he just has like bits and scraps of different things. Or he has a cigar box, but he doesn't care about the cigars in the box. He only likes the box. Or, you know, he's described as liking everything for all the wrong reasons. And it's indeed. Like... And for me, I really like that because I like to like things for the, like, after I read that, it made me want to like things for the wrong reasons in some sense, you know, like, because it's like, in some ways it helps you, I don't know how to verbalize this, but it's sort of like, it helps you like things in one, ultimately for the right reasons, you know, like, because then you can enjoy any cigar if you don't care about the cigars, you know, or you can enjoy any bottle of wine if you don't care about the bottle of wine itself, you know, like, and you only care about these other things or these peripheral things or whatever.
It kind of challenges the norm. It brings you back to something fundamental about things like beauty and truth, where we get hung up on almost a skewed version of that sometimes. And we'll say, oh, well, this cigar is great because it's expensive almost. Mm-hmm. Instead of you're missing the whole point of sitting back and smoking a cigar. It might not be my thing, but like the whole purpose is something bigger than just what kind of society says that it should be, I guess.
Right.
I really loved that that chapter where he unpacks is called The Luggage of an Optimist. Mm-hmm. That was just such a great title. I think throughout the book, I mean, the titles are really great of the chapters and things, and it's just the quality of the book is outstanding. So then after he unpacks, he opens a hatch in the roof and jumps up onto the roof and says, let's have a picnic outside on the roof. And some of the people join him and some of the people are like, you're crazy. But I found it really interesting that after he invited everybody to the roof, couple of the characters go up and sit and talk and they start to have their eyes opened a little bit, but he's not even there. He's almost just introducing them to that idea and then just letting them go because he knows that just that slight change in perspective is gonna do some stuff for them. So I thought that was really interesting that even though he's the catalyst, mm-hmm. it's almost like he's barely in the book.
Yeah, honestly. Especially like the first half or first portion or first third or whatever, like it's almost exactly right. Like he's sort of there, but like you're not like focusing on him at all until like later on and they start to tell stories explicitly about Innocent Smith. But whenever he goes up on the roof and takes that picnic and that one guy who they take that crummy bottle of wine up there. And he's so upset that he's enjoying this horrible, crappy bottle of wine. Like, he's like, this is the only real drink I've enjoyed in 9 years or 7 years or whatever. And it's like, and it's a watered down, crummy, cheap bottle of wine, you know, and this guy is like accustomed to drinking, from my understanding, like high-end liquors, high-end, you know, he's used to the upper echelon of like fine dining and drinking is what I assume based on his lifestyle or the way he responds to this bottle of wine. And it's like one of those things that's like perspective can change your enjoyment of even crappy things, you know, like where you're C.S. Lewis has this little sentence. I can't remember what book it's from, but what you see depends a great deal on where you're sitting, you know? And so it's like, it's likely that he got that from Chesterton himself because he's highly influenced by G.K. Chesterton. And so it's like one of those things where it's like you think of it and it seems mundane. It's like, yeah, okay, a sandwich is probably better eaten on the roof of my house than in the sewer gutter, you know. It's like, and not to say like or even better eaten in a nice field than at my dinner table sometimes, you know,
right.
Not to equate like the dinner table with the sewer gutter, but like that, it gives you that shift in perspective, that allows you to sort of like gain new eyes or see it in a different way, you know, like, I think he's really trying to, like, Dostoevsky, the way he describes a man, he says a man is something who can, or a being which grows used to everything. And in some sense, like G.K. Chesterton is like smashing that spell. Like he's like, these are the enchantments you cast to not become used to everything. You know, like this is how you avoid living an overfamiliar life or something like that, you know?
Yeah, just a sense of that falling asleep and falling into the trap of making the beautiful into mundane just because it happens to be there more than just once or twice. When you were talking about the kind of, it depends on where you're sitting thing, it reminded me of a study that I read a little while back where they did an experiment with people. They gave them the same food on either really fancy china or paper plates. And everybody across the board rated the food on the china as better, but it was exactly the same food. And it was just, it's a funny thing that we have that in our heads that, you know, just that slight difference can change how we feel about reality itself, which is a really interesting thing. It felt like that a lot, but in a way this book feels almost like the opposite. It's like he shattered the fancy plates so that you could see that the food was just as good.
Right. It's one of those things where it's like they'd all been eating on fancy plates their whole lives and they didn't really realize that, you know, that they sort of grew accustomed to this other lifestyle or whatever. And then he's just like, in some sense, like he elevated it by sort of like degrading it, you know, like instead of like eating in a fancy dining hall, eating on the roof, it's like, it really like wakes you up, that analogy towards, or that tilt us towards the idea of that we're asleep and need to be woken up from like the routine and things like that. Like, I think that's spot on because it's like, that's exactly what he did. You know, all of a sudden, once all the familiar sights and sounds and smells go away, you can really like see what you're doing, you know, taste what you're drinking, eat what, you know, everything becomes reinvigorated. You know, it's almost like doing a palate cleanse or something like that, where like you sort of wash everything off. And then, you know, now you can really taste things again, or you really experience life again.
Definitely. I'm reminded of two things, which I'll touch on quickly. Once I had a teacher who was really big on new experiences, and she didn't really care how they came about. And so once she said, try eating dinner in the shower with your eyes closed. Mm. And I don't think it was whole dinner, but I tried once eating in the shower with my eyes closed, and it was a vastly different experience. Mm. So it was just neat because she was one of the great teachers of my life. She just brought things to the table that nobody else did. And then the other thing I was going to say was, I'm not sure necessarily that you had mentioned the sewer versus your dinner table and things like that. I don't even necessarily know if we need, you know, an elevation, like instead of the dinner table, go to the field.
Right.
It could be as simple as, you know, go to the sewer or go to a different room or something. Like, it's that switch in perspective that really seems to do it, rather than necessarily like the value of where it is, I guess I would say. Like, if he had invited them to have a picnic in the basement, that might have done the same thing just because they're not used to it.
Right. Yeah. No. I do agree with. I was trying to find some sort of like, I guess like parallel. Like, I guess maybe it doesn't necessarily like the quality or type of difference doesn't matter so much as the difference itself. So it's like it only really matters that the thing that you change seats doesn't really matter where the other seat is, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it does to a degree, but
maybe. Yeah.
It's like, if you have no other option but, you know, that other seat over there, still go for the other seat, because
right.
it might dramatically change your perspective there.
Right. I guess I was trying to avoid the idea that there might be some places you could sit which would make you dislike your life more, you know. Like if someone, like and this is like where I maybe am pushing the thought too far, you know, like beyond its intention, you know, but it's like, and then again, I'm thinking over it. And I think that I don't think that there are any seats which are valueless, you know, like, cause I was trying to think in my mind, like, where is somewhere I wouldn't want to sit and eat my dinner. And I was like, well, maybe, a concentration camp in the height of the war, you know, like, and then I'm thinking of like, yes, maybe I wouldn't want to voluntarily eat my dinner in such a camp. But like, Viktor Frankl, or a guy who sums it up more succinctly, is like, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who wrote The Gulag Archipelago, and is and he won a Nobel Prize for literature, I think, for that book, actually, I think. But in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, he says something to the effect of, "Bless you, prison, for on your rotting prison mat straw, there I learned the secrets of the human soul." And background on him is he was part of Russia whenever the gulags were up and running, and he was thrown in one of the worst ones because he was a political activist. Like, he was a higher up person, and they got punished more than some of the other people. So his experience was worse than others. But in his acceptance speech, he literally blesses his old prison mat, you know, for having shown him a new perspective, basically, for having, and it was on that prison mat where he became a Christian and like turned over a new leaf and did all this other stuff. And like, then he went on to write this book, which has been like, which essentially some people attribute to Bringing Down the Wall. So maybe there are seats which maybe you wouldn't want to sit voluntarily. Maybe you wouldn't want to sit in a gulag or in the concentration camp. But I think that there's obviously value in those places, because a lot of great literature, books, a lot of good things ultimately came from those horrible seats, you know?
Yeah. I think that we can confuse these days value with maybe something else. Value doesn't have to mean that we like it, and doesn't have to mean that we want it to continue or anything of that sort. Like, we should work to get rid of gulags, but it doesn't mean that it's worthless. It kind of reminds me of your sweatshirt, the anti-nihilism shirt, you know? Mm-hmm. We can look at things from a nihilistic perspective and say, yeah, it doesn't really mean anything. Suffering is pointless. But it's not necessarily pointless. Suffering can be extraordinarily valuable, even though it is also awful and we don't necessarily want it. And I wouldn't recommend that we run to suffering, but when suffering comes, if we look at it with everything we can to pull the value out of it, I think that that transforms it into something. It reminds me kind of of the Great Divorce, that sense of, I think that's where the line comes from, the people in who will ultimately be in hell will realize that it was hell all along, and the people in heaven will realize it was heaven all along. Mm-hmm. It's kind of that feeling of that value. The perspective change just changes that value tremendously.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And that's really, that quote from The Great Divorce is such a pointed one, you know, because that's exactly right. And it's like one of my favorite quotes from that book, because it's so, powerful, the idea that either of those states work back retroactively, you know. Right. There's a line in the Old Testament at the end of Genesis where he says something like, what you meant for evil, God intended for good to preserve many alive. And so it's like, it's one of those things that it works back retroactively in some sense, you know.
And I think that was from Joseph, right? Joseph, yeah, was the one who said that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great example, because he was kidnapped by his brothers and forced into slavery, and then he had a really crappy life for a very long time. And sometimes we forget that, because we jump from, oh, he got kidnapped into slavery, oh, now he's second in command of all of Egypt. But no, there were a lot of years of real bad stuff in between.
Yeah.
But he was able to look back and be like, no, that was worth it. I'd do it again.
Yeah, and almost all modern medicine is born from suffering, essentially. Like, if there was, we would, now of course you could make the argument that, you know, we wouldn't need modern medicine if suffering didn't exist, you know, but like, if suffering didn't exist, you also wouldn't exist, you know? So it's like one of those like weird, like backwards cutting arguments where it's like, yeah, you can cut off all of suffering, but like, what we call you, Adam, and this, the way that I exist now doesn't exist without some considerable suffering, you know? So it's like, it's one of those things that's like part and parcel. You can't wish it away because it's integral to you, who you are as a person, you know?
Yeah. And that kind of touches on the problem of evil, which is beyond the scope of our discussion here.
Yeah,
but it's a really fascinating topic, definitely worth exploring.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll steer us back over to Chesterton so that we don't get too far off. I think then after we have our rooftop and the setting up of the High Court of Beacon, that's when our antagonist comes along. Do you remember his name? I can't even.
He is
Warren.
I think
Warner.
It's
Dr. Warner.
Warner.
Dr. And Warner Moses. And Cyrus Prim.
Oh yeah, Cyrus Prim. Moses Gould is the other guy.
Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was an interesting character for me because I never quite, I guess, grasped him. I could kind of picture the others and I could kind of get where they were coming from, but he was like a wild card where he almost was just in there saying what he was saying because he enjoyed saying what he was saying. It was interesting. But the doctors come along and they accuse Innocent of polygamy and murder and all sort of thievery and breaking and entering and all kinds of things. And so they're ready to take him away to, and I think it's Mr. Moon who says, now hold on, we have a high court now here. So tomorrow we're just going to hold a session and we're going to put him on trial. And some of the people become his defense and some of the people take on the prosecution. And then we get to hear more of the story. But it's very interesting that we get the stories in parts. And it's only in the completion of both parts that we see the point. And that was something really poignant to me because we are kind of in a world right now where we get a lot of half-truths. And boy, if you just have the half, you're never going to get the whole. I hate that it's a favorite thing of mine now, but it is a favorite thing of mine. On Twitter, whenever I come across something that is instantly either emotional or dramatic, I will click on it, go through the replies, see what the opposing people, because there's always opposing people, have to say, see if anybody has done a little more research and dug into whatever the tweet is about and posted some more information. And I've gotten to the point where I can pretty consistently withhold judgment entirely until I've done that work. And it's a great thing. And I hope more people will do it, because what can instantly trigger you and make you feel a certain way, if you dig in a little further, you might find is vastly different. The man who shot at somebody was not shooting at them because of the way that you thought that they were in the case of the book. Do you want to talk a little bit about the peace gun?
Yeah, the gun that deals life rather than death. Yeah, that's man, that is one of the most important symbols in the whole book. You know, that's actually there's sort of like there's a couple things about that. It's like one, it's so ironic, like in both Chesterton's style and I think C.S. Lewis's style, and then many other people's styles kind of built around this idea of like it's like paradigm shift or gestalt switch or, you know, like the are turning the tables or flipping the tables, you know, where it's like you turn something upside down on its head and push it straight through. Like whenever you're in an argument with someone and they say something and they, it's like an offhanded comment about whatever it may be, I like the color blue. All animals should be blue. And you say, like, okay. Well, and you kind of drill down and you push it. You just keep pushing on it, basically. And it starts to go the other way on the person. You know, it's like, well, actually, you know, some animals might lose their being or essence by making them blue, you know, like a giraffe or a chick, like a baby chick, like those are distinctly yellow things and they may lose some of their essence by being blue. But anyway, to sort of bring it back, this idea of the gun that deals life, you know, it's like one of those things where it's like he takes it to the nihilistic professor, you know, and he has this long argument with them and he says, okay, you know, you literally value death over life. Like your whole entire philosophical system is built up so that death is preferable to life. And then he finally says something like, let's drown the puppy then, basically, you know, like, and he pulls out his pistol and he's, you know, it's loaded. It's a real pistol. And he chases the professor out onto, one of the flying buttresses, one of the gargoyles or whatever. And then continues to have the argument with them, you know, like, I thought you preferred life, or I thought you preferred death to life. I thought that, you know, life was just endless suffering and torment and there was no enjoyment to be found in it at all. And that we're all wasting our time here. There's no meaning or purpose. There's no design. There's no, none of that. There's no love. There's, it's just a short, painful story, and then it's all over. And then, true to form, he makes this professor admit, you know, like by being afraid of death, in some sense, he comes to his senses, you know, like he jars him awake by having him confront death, you know. And this is actually like pretty... this is something that happens to a lot of people. They have a near-death experience and they change their life. Of course, a lot of people don't change their lives. Like there's a good amount of backing that shows that people would sometimes rather die than change. Like in the case of like smoking cessation or alcohol abuse, substance abuse, like some people quite literally would just rather die than stop doing that thing. But I think it does matter the quality of the stimulus, you know, like, so a gun to your head is different than a cigarette in your mouth, you know, like a cigarette may kill you, but not instantly. It's going to take years of smoking those little white, you know, sticks for you to see anything. And even once you develop the life-threatening illness, it's still not very clear to you that you're going to die from it because you can sort of like blind yourself from it. But a gun to your head, it's like, it's jarring. It wakes you up, you know, better than any alarm clock ever could, you know? And that's what happens to the professor. He gets woken up, you know, he says he'll do anything at all to get off this wall and to come back into the room and sit down. And so Innocent presses him on that idea of anything. And then he says, okay, fine, then you'll do anything. Give me a song, give us a dance, sing about the joy of life and your enjoyment of it, you know? Do you want to talk more about it or do you want me to just keep
going? No, I mean, that's just, it's such a great point. And it felt to me a little bit like the halfway point of the book. I don't know if it really was, but that was like the turning point in a lot of ways. One thing I wanted to add there was, and I think it's such an important point, and I wish I could articulate it well, but I'll just give it my all. Innocent afterwards talks to the teacher and says, the reason I did this was not really to wake you up. The reason I did this was because I believed you. You convinced me. And I needed to know if it was true or not. And this was the only way that I could figure out to know. And if it was true, then I was going to just join you because there's no reason for any of it. But if I hoped that it wasn't, or I don't even know if he said he hoped he wasn't, but it was fascinating to me that the reason he did all this was really not from a place of superiority. It was from a place of innocence. It was from a place of, maybe you're right. Maybe you're right that this is true. how can I know if it's true or not? Because I need to know, because this is really important. I mean, I don't think really there's much more important in this life than those sort of questions of value, of meaning, of things like that. So he really wanted to know, and this was the method that he figured out in order to know. But I felt that that was really, really important, because it could have easily felt vastly different if he already knew it was fake and he did it because he was superior. Like, this was a professor he really honored and believed. But I thought that was really interesting, that little extra bit.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. In some sense, I might have found it a little bit off-putting if he came down to bear his weight on his professor. You know, like, I know this is wrong, and I'm going to show you that you actually know it's wrong too. You know, it's like when you read, he's like, look, we both just escaped death. You know, he's like, you escaped death. You were pointing a gun at me. You know, like, right. He goes, yeah, but look, if you had held to your claims, I would have no choice but to believe you. And then, after offing you off myself, essentially, you know, it's like, it just makes the whole experience more enduring, you know, like more profound, because he was genuinely like, I believe this professor. He's a world renowned pessimistic. He knows the pessimistic philosophers. Like, he's brilliant. He's analytic. Like, he has published papers. He's written books. Like, he is the smartest guy that I've ever come in contact with. And so I have to know if he really believes what he's telling me, because if he really believes it and he teaches it to me and I can't help but believe, because I have no arguments against it, like, what better way in that sense to press this idea where, you know, he essentially says suicide is the best action you can do in existence. Like, how else do you try it, or how else do you really examine it other than seeing exactly what he would do if offered, you know, choice, you know? And
and I don't even necessarily, I to a degree it's suicide, but I think there's an important distinction of it being forced suicide in a way.
Well, like, yeah,
because if he had come to him on the professor's worst day, when the professor was already ready to be done with life, then that would have made it had a different outcome. But he came to the professor at the height of the professor's glory, essentially. Like, the professor is a big shot at the college. And so to come to him at that point is vastly different. It reminds me, and you'll probably know more than I, it's either a Chesterton or a Lewis quote, I think, that says, you never know just quite what you believe until it's a matter of life or death.
Yeah, that's a C.S. Lewis quote.
Okay. That reminded me of that.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. They go back and forth a lot. But it was like, okay, well, here it is. So what do you believe? For the folks who didn't get to read it yet, the prosecution initially talks about how Innocent cornered the professor and tried to kill him, but didn't finish the job or something. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they're trying him for murder. And that's when they get a letter from the actual professor himself. The defense responds with that letter and says, no, that's not what happened. Here's what happened. And so then we go into a series of vignettes, I guess, of that back and forth. We have the prosecution saying, look at this event that happened. Look how terrible he is. And then we have the defense come and say, well, you didn't have the whole story. So I think the next one is the robbery. Is that?
I believe so. With the curate, I think that might be the next one. Where he, this one's a little bit more vague for me, but he essentially,
I can jump in. I think I remember. Yeah. They're having a debate, I think, and then Innocent gets some folks to leave with him, two guys. And he says, we're going to break into somebody's house. And so they're going along, and one of the guys is following, and the other one's starting to second guess this. And he's just like, I don't know, this is kind of crazy. And finally, the second guy says, I can't be part of this, I'm leaving. But there's something about it that the first guy just is curious. So he decides to follow Innocent, and Innocent finds this chimney, and he knocks half of the chimney off, and he starts climbing down the chimney to break into this house. And the guy's like, I don't know what I'm doing here, but he decides to follow him, and he follows him into the house. And the guy inside is or once they get down, I think Innocent starts taking stuff and robbing the place. And so that's kind of the prosecution side. But then when the defense comes up, they get the full story from the guy. Oh, and then I think the guy's never seen again. So they figure that the Innocent murdered him. But once you get the full story, it turns out that the house that they broke into was Innocent Smith's house. And the reason that he did it was to capture that sort of feeling of what you have, because it's almost like we covet what other people have. And so when you treat what you have as almost somebody else's, it again reframes things for you, and it puts it in that new light that you once had. Because at some point, everything that we own is new, and it's new to us, and it's exciting. But then, you know, you hang the painting on the wall, or you put the book on the shelf, and maybe it's not quite that same buzz. And then we have things like retail therapy, where people just go shop until they're poor because they want that buzz again. So I thought that spoke kind of to that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, again, like he's always like reframing the whole time. He's always reframing everything, family, philosophically, like just the mundane everyday life, professional life, anything that you can think of, he's trying to reframe and like flip on its head, basically. And like that idea when he's breaking into his house, it's like, it's so like silly to think that, but like in another sense, I hadn't thought about, in terms of like coveting and like treating it like someone else's stuff. Like that's a really good, like line to draw, because it is in sense, like he's like, you know, acting as if it's not his. And so like you do tend to treat, other people's things in some sense better than your own things, you know, and you even treat other people sometimes better than you treat yourself. Or, you know, there's some studies that have been done to show that people are more likely to give their pets prescribed medication than take their own prescribed medication themselves, you know? So like people are more likely to take care of their dogs than they are to take care of themselves. And so like, in some sense, like acting as if you're someone else's, acting if your things are someone else's, acting as if you were someone else in some sense, like, then you kind of you do reframe it, and it sort of reestablishes the value. There's this one quote from the Netflix adaptation of the, or maybe it's the BBC adaptation of Sherlock Holmes with Benedict Cumberbatch. But there's an episode and a scene in that show where he just keeps repeating the phrase, "Your life is not your own. Keep your hands off it." And in some sense, like that's like the mantra of like Christian life in particular, you know, where it's like you're trying to remind yourself that like, I need to preserve all of this. I'm living on borrowed time, with borrowed, everything is borrowed in a sense, like none of it is self-created. And in that sense, since nothing is self-created, in some sense, it doesn't belong to in the true sense that we use the word ownership. You know, like you can say ownership is something in which like you purchase it and there's some sort of contract exchange and you own it, you know, like, but if you take it all the way back, like your life is something that you didn't do any of those things to gain, you know, like I didn't sign a contract at birth, you know, establishing ownership of my organs, bones, and, you know, skin or whatever, or my mind, you know, like just something given to me on loan, you know, like I against my will in some sense.
I had a concept that I toyed with for a while and I've kind of put it on the back burner, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. It's almost though as though the only thing that we truly possess is our will, and it depends on, you know, if you're Calvinist and things like that, even if you have that, but everything else is on loan. It's almost like the only thing that you ever really got, and it was totally given to you, is your will. You could do with it whatever you want, but all the other stuff is going back at some point. You know, you're not going to get to hold on to it. So it just kind of reminded me of that, where we can do so much with our will. Like, we can affect so many other things with it. We can affect our bodies that are temporary. We can affect the stuff we have, which is temporary. All these things. But the one thing that always seems to remain constant is that we get to make those choices and we get to have that decision on what to do with the stuff that otherwise we're loaned. Now, it's possible that we'd even get loaned our will, but that's stuff that I've not explored fully, so.
Yeah, I mean, just on a first look, I think I could agree with you to a certain extent, you know, where it's like, there's the physical drives and processes and all of that, like, and C.S. Lewis calls them like notes on a piano or notes on an instrument, you know, like the thing that chooses between the notes can't be the notes themselves. So like we may be made up of drives, instincts, and biological processes, but there's something behind those in some sense that's like choosing which ones to play at one time and which ones to play at another time. At least it has the appearance of that, you know, like there's something behind all of what's going on out here that's choosing, you know, like between one thought or another, that chooses not to act on one, you know, one thing or another. He's using that as like a moral analogy, you know, like there are I can choose to help my child or help my dog. And it's like, those are, you know, it may be moral in one instance to help my dog and moral in one instance to help my child. But you can't, let's say there's a time in which both of them are in trouble. You choose one or the other, you know, like, and so like, in some sense, like that's like a socialized value hierarchy or something like that, where you like, you do place your child above your dog for obvious reasons. And some of those are social, like projected on you. And then some of those are like innate biological reasons you might prefer your child to your dog. But like ultimately, like you, like there's something choosing those instincts, you know, like there's something behind that's saying, okay, I'm, you know, if two things rank in the same, rung of my value hierarchy or whatever, like how do I differentiate between this or that, you know, like, so I think maybe like there probably could be some good arguments made for ownership of the will, you know.
I don't remember if we were talking about it or somewhere else, but there's a philosophical donkey that describes that, where if you put a donkey directly between two piles of identical food, this particular philosophical donkey, if it can't choose, will just die of starvation because it's identical. Now, it wouldn't happen in reality, but it's a nice mm-hmm. thought experiment. But, you know, at some point, because we don't live in that philosophical thought experiment, the donkey is going to just choose one or the other. Like,
right.
It's not going to choose to starve, or it's not going to not eat because right. it's confused between the two.
Right.
Continuing with the book, I think then after the burglary, is that where we start talking about, I think we have little bits of his wives, quote unquote.
The claim of bigamy, I think. Yeah. I don't know if bigamy comes first or if his trip around the world is,
I wasn't sure either. I think it might be intertwined. There, it seemed to jump around at the end there. It wasn't mm-hmm. quite so clear cut. Short version of the story is they present a bunch of cases where he has wooed some girl and run off to elope with her. And they say, you know, if he's married, the first time that he does this is against the law. So we're putting him in jail. And it's happened multiple times by a number of different accounts. And so the defense side says, well, hang on a second. That is only the case if it was a different girl. And so what we learn is that he and his wife, God bless her that she would go along with this craziness, they basically reenact their courtship over and over and over again. And she says at the end, as she's talking to her friend, you know, we leave our kids for a few days with our aunt, and they're okay. And we know they're okay. And so then we go and do this because it's important for our relationship, and it keeps things just full of life, which I thought was really interesting. I really enjoyed that part. You start, I don't know about you, but I started to grasp that was happening halfway through, but it was mm-hmm. still fun to see it to play out all the way.
Yeah, once there's like a crucial bit where he talks about people dressing in accordance to their name and working in accordance to their name. And so like he says, you know, like if your last name is brown or red or green, like you would dress in those colors, or maybe your name would be in accordance with your hair color. And so like if you have brown hair, your last name would be brown and you would wear brown clothes. And so like periodically, like you find out slowly, inch by inch, that, you know, like he marries Mary Brown, Mary Green, Mary, and then Mary Gray, you know? And so it's like, you find out that it's just his wife wearing different colored dresses, basically. And he just calls her those names because of his silly idea that names should mean something, you know, that names should correspond to who you are, what you look like, or something like that. And yeah, but I still agree with you. Like the whole time I was like reading those portions, it's like smiling, cause it's like funny to think that, like, you know, in some sense it was like they judged a book by its cover, or they had these half truths, you know, where they were like, it's clearly bigamy, you know, it's like, but on second look, like most things, all those disparities dissolved, you know. And it's like, that's the way it is with a lot of things. And like, generally the whole book is kind of concerned with seeing things for what they really are, you know, like it's like really, really like taking off the glasses, wiping your eyes clear, and actually seeing reality for what it really is, you know, like seeing how fantastic it is that you can drink wine at all. Not that it matters what the wine is, but just the fact that you can have wine, or that you can eat food, and, you know, or you can, that you could be married or own a house or have cigars or whatever. Like, it's like, it's just like, it's more concerned with like, well, with the title and the telegram at the beginning, he's like, the telegram at the very beginning is, man found alive with two legs, or man alive with two legs. And the word man alive is put together for whatever reason. And he's astonished to just be alive, because it could have been otherwise. You could be dead, you know, like very easily, you know, like there's not a lot, you know, cause so it's like concerned with seeing things for what it is. And then like not taking that for granted, you know, because like I said, you could be dead. Life is fragile, you know, especially like with COVID and all of that, like, it's really sort of taken those blinders off us and really, allowed us to see life in some sense for what it really is, you know. Like we were never safe. We were never living normal lives, you know, like C.S. Lewis says, there's never been a normal person, you know, it is immortals whom you joke with, live with, and snub, you know? And so it's like, this book is like a testament to, you know, to that, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It reminded me in a couple places of scene on from Paralandra, which is the second of the space trilogy, where the main character eats different things, and they're like the greatest thing ever. And he says at one point, I came across this other fruit or whatever it was, and I ate it, and it wasn't quite as good as it was different. You know, it wasn't as good as that other thing. And so then I thought, well, should I just go search for that other thing? But he didn't, because he realized that what was in front of him was the important thing, and it was different, and it was okay that it was different, and that kind of thing. It reminded me in a sense of that, because you had the wine or the cigars or whatever it is that you have, and the wine and cigars that you have, you don't have to sit there and compare it to that other one. Like, you just enjoy it for what it is. And it's, it was pretty, I really like that part of Paralandra.
I agree, where it's that idea that the pleasure you're experiencing at the moment is the best pleasure, because it is, it's so, yeah, you're experiencing it. It's unique to that moment, you know, like it's incomparable to any other moment, you know, like, because it differs in time, space, you know, quality. Like, it's like all, you know, it would be improper to compare all pleasures and say this one and that one, I want those. Or, and he talks about the sickness it would be to just repeat it over and over again. To there are these like bubble trees that burst, and like, yeah, are the most like, it's like the best feeling in the world whenever the water pours over you, you know. And he says, you know, it would almost be a sickness to just sit there and let those, you know, experience that over and over and over again, you know. And and then he finds this whole species of animals that like they only mate with their spouse once, you know, and then they talk about the maturation of that pleasure, you know. It's like half the pleasure is in remembering it, you know, like it's a, and it's not a full grown pleasure until it's remembered, you know. And then it inspires poetry and all this other stuff, you know. It's like no one, everyone and also thinks as pleasure is pleasure is being sort of like a one-off single moment, you know. It's like, well, they can work, you know, they can not, they can work backwards like we had talked about early on, you know. Yeah. Like, but they can also progress, they can also grow into the future, you know.
Yeah, definitely. The maturity and the appreciation of it whenever you get to that point is pretty cool. And I think as much as we lament aging in at least our society presently, there's something really magical about that, because as you get older, you really do appreciate stuff so much more and differently. And I was thinking the other day of the quote, the youth is wasted on the young. Because I was, I don't know, something hurt. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I wish I was 20 something. But no, I really don't, because I was an idiot back then. It's just, it's fascinating to have that appreciation. I think life changes when you have that appreciation. That gratitude, it's just everything. I think then our last little bit of the book, and that'll probably take us to the end of the discussion, so that works, is his trip around the world. You want to do the trip around the world?
Sure. Yeah. So along with this entering his house through different, you know, avenues, whether it's breaking in through the chimney or the window, he decides that he's going to take a trip to the sacred house, which happens to be his house, but he doesn't go through the front door. He wants to go through the back door. He doesn't just walk around the house. He walks around the world. And so as he's going around the world, he stops off at different areas in China, Australia. He meets a hermit in the mountains, and each time along the way, he meets a different person, and he tells him the story and recites poetry about this, his house, essentially, like the beauty of his house, the sanctity of his house, like how important his house is to him. This is from my memory, but you know, and he, and like, he's just talking about, and people are kind of confused. They think he's crazy, basically, because at one point he comes up out of the sea from a rowboat, and he's like this monstrous hulking man, and his clothes are ripped and he's dirty. And like the hermit is so confused by him. And he's like, yeah, I'm looking for the red house. Have you seen the red house? And eventually he sort of circles all the way back around, and you find out that he is indeed just going through his back door, you know, that he, the red house is his house, and to appreciate it, it's something he calls, like, elsewhere in one of his other books, the long and perpetual journey home, or something to that effect, you know. And he mentions it, G.K. Chesterton mentions this story that he would never tell, but he did end up telling it in Man Alive, which is the idea of a guy who leaves off and travels to foreign land only to discover that it was his land, you know. And he talks about all the thrill and delight of landing in what you might think to be New Africa, but really finding out that it's simply downtown Ireland, you know. And like, you climb up to the building turrets and you put your flag down only to realize that instead of discovering new whales, you discovered Wales, you know. And so it's that idea of like gaining a new perspective on the whole environment, like being told you're somewhere else, but in reality, you never even knew where you were to begin with, because if you were aware of your surroundings, you would know if you landed back in Ireland after setting out from Ireland, you know. But it's that it's that break. It's like that shattering of what you have like crystallized in your mind. It's like shattering your memory and your preconceived notions, and like showing you the world and landscape all fresh and new, you know.
Definitely. It reminds me a little bit of even when we go on vacation and things, you know, when, if you come back from a long trip, you're just glad to be home, and home feels different than when you left. And it's almost renewed and refreshed, and it's a really great feeling. I have traveled to the other side of the world and to China and things, and after those long trips, when you get back to your bed, it's just like, oh my gosh, this is the best bed in the world. Because it's mine, and it's because it's the one that I know, and it's the one that knows me almost. I'll tell you this. If there was one thing in the book that, I don't know if one of these words confused me or didn't sit as well with me or something, it was a struggle for me that he left his wife and went around the world. Yeah. Like, she talks about it in the end and says, I was fine with it. You know, I can take care of the kids. I knew he wasn't going to be gone that long. But part of me was just like kind of frustrated with him that he did that.
Yeah.
And so if I have one complaint, I guess, about the book, it was just like, maybe that was too innocent. Maybe that was pushing it too far, because there was a duty and a responsibility that, at least for that little bit of time, he kind of neglected.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
Yeah, with all of his whimsy, he does in some sense jeopardize the like safety of his family in some senses, and like he does, it does seem that he shirks some responsibility and throughout the story, because he's obviously acting like a child, you know, like I do agree with you, like having a childlike mentality and that innocent attitude, like generally is a good thing, but there are of course cases where you have to be very serious, you know, and it talks about how Innocent Smith is really only serious when he's being happy, you know, like, or the more silly things get, the more serious he becomes, and the more serious things get, the more silly he becomes. In some sense, it's like that, it's that inversion again, to like kind of shatter like preconceived norms or whatever. But there are some detriments to that, because like in some cases, like, you need to be serious about serious things, you know, certainly some of the times, at least, you know, like it would be weird if you showed up to a funeral home, you know, laughing and giggling, you know, like in front of the bereaved faces. Yeah. But you know, like.
But I think that I would say, so to conclude that thought, though, in his defense, the fact that his wife was okay with it mattered. Because it was like an okay thing to do. So touching on your funeral thing, my mother wants her funeral to be a party. She has a sign that she kept for, oh, I don't know, decades now, that says woohoo. And she literally wants me to put it on her coffin. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, sure. And she wants me to play Beatle music. And I'm like, sure. And she wants it to be a celebration, because that, I mean, she's happy, she's home, mm-hmm. she's good. And because you have that, it's a night and day difference between going to a funeral, people are weeping and being silly, and going to a funeral where people want to be silly and being silly with them, I guess I would say. Mm-hmm. And I feel like he got that. And that's why it didn't ruin anything for me. It was this nagging thing inside, but it didn't destroy anything, because I was like, all right, I can accept that he was able to do this because his wife gave him the grace to do it.
Right.
And in a very real sense, man, I really do think that she's the hero of that story, because she puts up with him.
Yeah, I just can't imagine behaving that way and then, like, you know, maintaining any relationship, because that just the way he acts is so spontaneous, it would be, I think, impossible to keep up with him, you know.
Yeah.
Like, just always running off to new adventures.
But I think that we, you know, it is a story. It's an allegory. So we can take from it what the point is, instead of making it so literal and fundamentalism that we would ruin it.
Sure.
We can look at that and say, sometimes I'm just goofy around my wife and she rolls her eyes, but I always say afterwards, you'd miss me if I wasn't here. And it's true. Yeah. And so, like, we can do those things and we can have that fun and it's okay. And I hope people will read the book, and I hope that it will be as eye-opening for them, because it's worth it. It's a really good read.
I agree. And it's not like any book that I've seen published today. It's one of those things that's like, it's just unique, and we'll give you, I think it's better, like, if you want a new perspective on life, like a new perspective on your work, your relationships, anything like that, I don't recommend picking up a self-help book. You could get just as much out of reading this book, Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton, as you would any pop psych book that's out there, you know? provided you're willing to learn from it, you know, and that you can read it in such a way. Some people don't have they don't read fiction like with that kind of like intention. But like, if you can say, this is supposed to teach me something, and then read it with those eyes, like you will inevitably get something out of it.
Yeah. Just the openness. You approach it with that open attitude of, what is this saying? Is it, you know, go beyond just the silly story and really, it really made me want to go have picnics on the roof. I'll tell you.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I'm typically, like a rather, generally a pessimistic person. But like that actually, like in some people, C.S. Lewis might have said this, maybe someone else said this, but he said, and whether he meant literally or figuratively, you can decide, but so there are two types of people. This is C.S. Lewis. Sorry. I'm running the quote through my database. C.S. Lewis was, he said, there are two types of people out there. There are those who enjoy happiness and like happiness. And then there are those, for whatever reason, genuinely do not like happiness. And typically I would be in that, you know, previously I was in that do not like happiness category, but I recognize that being a bad thing, like it's important to like happiness, you know? It's like one of those things, like people like Innocent Smith are important because they're like that, you know, they have that inversion, you know, that ability to, and then like to just take the blinders off and to see truly and to be a legitimate optimist, which I think is important because it's it's good for your health for starters, and I think it's the right way to perceive things for seconds, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. To appreciate good, there's really not much higher that you can do with life.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the biggest thing for me. It was like to be virtuous and to actually like virtue and goodness itself, you know. And so it's like, and that's half the challenge, especially now, because it's so popular to be pessimist, to like badness in that sense, you know. Yes. And it's just not good for anybody, really.
Indeed.
But I think I'm prepared to call it here. I think we made it an hour, and I think we kind of covered the whole book, really.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. I'm glad that we had it, and I definitely appreciate the recommendation on the book. Yes. I will pass it along to anybody who's listening/watching. Again, it's Man Alive. It's all one word, and it's by G.K. Chesterton. One thing I would add, just as a tail end, you mentioned that even though it was written a long time ago, it feels super modern, and I would back that up. It's ridiculous how easy it was to read. Sometimes you get a book of this age and there's language in it that's just like, what? But it was a really easy read. And if you pick it up, stick with it at least till the second chapter, because that's when it gets really good.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you took the time to read it. Most people don't read what I recommend. So that was awesome. And I'm glad that you got as much value out of it as I did. And I hope other people can join in and enjoy the story like us.
Definitely.
Awesome. All right. Well, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Do you just want to let people know where they can find more of you?
You bet. Always. You can head over to jkriki.com. It's jkriki.com. Or you can swing by Twitter. I just actually released a new book on NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month. So if you're a writer, you might want to check that one out. It's on Amazon now. I was excited to finally publish another book, and I'm jumping on and going to continue some writing there. And so I appreciate the opportunity to plug it.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, always a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to watch this episode of Will Work for Purpose. If you found anything here interesting, you can always leave a comment below or email me at mosley@tweakingo.com. If you were watching this podcast on YouTube, you can find audio versions of it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else major podcasts are found. So thanks for watching, and we'll see you in the next one.